responding first to Mr. Montgomery will be Thomas Landis. He received his BA and MA from Vanderbilt University, his PhD from the University of South Carolina, and has taught at Converse College, Furman University, and is at present chairman of the English department at the University of Dallas. He's published two books of literary criticism and approximately 75 periodical pieces, including poetry and articles in Modern Age, Georgia Review, the Southern Review, and the Suwannee Review. His latest and most scholarly work is a guide to garage sales and flea markets in Dallas, Texas. Mr. Landis.
I might add it's my only scholarly work. Professor Montgomery's brilliant paper needs no correction. He has rightly located the genius of Southern literature in its preoccupation with a proper notion of evil. To those of us familiar with the body of work to which he refers, his analysis seems undeniably true, if uncommon in its particular insights. But this is the Philadelphia Society. What about the Philadelphians? Do they understand Mr. Montgomery's remarks about Faulkner, Flannery O'Connor, and the rest? Let me hasten to say that I don't mean to impugn their intelligence. All the standardized tests prove that Yankees are smarter than Southerners. If we'd only had the IQ and the SAT scores in 1861, we could have predicted the outcome of the war and saved 500,000 lives. But it's an old familiar song to us, the one Mr. Montgomery has been singing, and I doubt that it's been heard nearly so often in Philadelphia. For this reason, I'd like to say a few words to the Philadelphians among us by way of further explanation. First, we're really not so different from you, at least not in our capacity to sin. Recently, I spent a Saturday night in Philadelphia watching as the local TV station reported the banalities of the day. There were fund drives, council meetings, political speeches, all the usual sins. And to a Southerner visiting there for the first time, Philadelphians seemed no better than South Carolinians, which from a spectator's point of view is to say that they were no worse, because the only thing people really want to watch on television or read about in books is evil. Nothing else really satisfies. We all tolerate a few cheerful stories thrown in amidst reports of atrocities, but we can't abide too many of them. Recently, a newspaper began publication with a stated policy of reporting only good news. It folded within a short time. Any Southern writer could have predicted its fate. Meanwhile, the National Enquirer was selling copies in ever-increasing millions with headlines like, "Mad Dentist Removes Girl's Tongue," and "Female Penguins Emasculate Scientists." But on that Saturday evening newscast, there was nothing so exotic. Then two stories were flashed on the screen, which made Philadelphia, for a moment, extremely interesting. The first concerned a lynching which took place in rural Pennsylvania, not in the time of Benjamin Franklin, but in the year 1979. I couldn't believe it. Was this the Quaker State or Alabama? I looked out the hotel window to be certain that Independence Hall was still standing below. And indeed, there it was, with the Liberty Bell encased in a modern glass building just across the street. The next story that caught my attention was the report of a Ku Klux Klan rally in New Jersey, just down the road a piece. It seems that the local Clavering had staged a huge demonstration in August of this year, and its grand dragon was suddenly on camera before me, telling everybody in a clipped Yankee accent that they hadn't seen anything yet, that there would be bigger and better rallies in the near future. As I say, we're really not so different from you. But over the past 50 years, our writers have somehow set themselves apart from yours by their capacity to deal with those special depravities that occasionally live on a late-night TV broadcast. I don't mean to suggest that they are exploiters of the sensational in the way that stringers for the National Enquirer are. In fact, they are subtle and delicate in their work, the way Mozart would be if he were writing the score for the Charles Manson murders. They simply know where the soul really lives, the depths to which it sinks in self-revelry. Alan Tate has pointed out the irony inherent in the fact that Eastern critics once scoffed at A Rose for Emily by William Faulkner as utterly beyond credulity. Who could believe that an old lady would sleep with the corpse of her dead lover for the last years of her life? Then, after the story's publication, authorities discovered just such a case, not in Mississippi, but in New York City. In fact, no such thing had occurred in Faulkner's hometown of Oxford. But he had guessed at the potential depravity of the proud, spurned hearts of old ladies. Both Tate and Faulkner have written subtly and movingly about lynchings. Can we expect that in the near future we will begin to read such stories written by Philadelphians? If we do, I am willing to predict that the action will take place in Tupelo. But Southern writers have placed the blame where it belongs, on the home folks. Not because these writers hate their region, but because they understand its humanity, the innate wickedness which it shares with every other place on the planet Earth. In one sense, the power of Southern fiction lies in the very fact that it is not about the South, but merely takes place there. Thus, it has a fine particularity that gives flesh and bone to its universal soul. In that respect, it is analogous to the created order itself. We delight in its accidental variety and are spiritually moved by its substantial revelation of the divine. As it is with great literature, so it is with people. Understanding this truth, who would believe that Faulkner, in his greatest work, is saying anything of importance about Mississippi or the South that he isn't saying about Philadelphia and the East? And in A Rose for Emily, he is not merely rendering the pride and madness of certain old ladies, but ours as well. We all sleep with the corpses of our dead lovers, and Faulkner knew that about us before he ever began to concoct his tale of horror. To boil the matter down to an essential proposition, the best of Southern literature is characterized by its ontological orthodoxy. For the most part, Southern writers believe in the incarnation and all that such a miraculous event implies. The flesh, the concrete particulars of time and place, are therefore important, good, and hence sacred. That's why a few Southern stories of lynchings occur at no time and in no place, as is the case of The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, the rendition of an action which could not have occurred in Mississippi. In that story, as you may recall, without anyone really knowing why, members of a village conduct an annual lottery in order to choose one among them to be stoned to death by the rest. In the final scene, a woman is duly chosen, whereupon those of her own family, including her small child, join the rest in the ritual execution, and with relative unconcern. But as I said, none of this occurs in Mississippi. In the first place, if such a practice were to persist, say in Yazoo City, any number of old maid aunts would be able to tell you precisely why it was done. Their facts might be in error, but they would have an explanation. And in the second place, no one in that part of the country would participate in organized cruelties that cut so easily across family lines. Other kinds of cruelties might be, indeed are, perfectly acceptable in Mississippi, but where the South is still the South, the family remains its most important institution. And indeed, it is the family that has given Southern writers their true subject matter. For where else do you learn about the remarkable virtuosity of sin except from your own flesh and blood? Such conduct as Miss Emily's, were it to occur in Mississippi, and come to think of it, maybe it did, would be a family scandal to be hidden at all costs from the eyes of outsiders and then whispered about at reunions for the next 100 years. Sooner or later, such tales find their way into print, with names altered in order to protect the writer from the wrath of his kinsmen, who, despite his protests, never quite trust his loyalty again. And yet, what else is he to do? He must write about things he knows, and what he knows best is the family, which includes the distant as well as the near, the dead as well as the living. And when he writes, he is involved in a communal act, for all the aunts and cousins who accuse him of treason have been his accomplices in repeating the old gossip. And they know it, which is why they are so hard on him. Perhaps in response to their disapproving stares, William Faulkner once said, "A writer will kill his grandmother for a good story. Ode on a Grecian urn is worth any number of old ladies." Of course, he really didn't mean it. With few exceptions, old ladies come off well in his fiction. But something of his attitude is essential to the good poet or novelist. He must be willing to tell all, whatever the cost to his region, his public preoccupations, his personal pride. And Southern writers tell all, because with their familial consciousness, they know all. Know it so well that they do not easily fall victim to ideological distortions. For example, the family never completely exonerates its errant members just because they are economically deprived. To do so would be to remove from all the kinship their dignity as free human beings and creatures of God. But neither is the sinner cast out completely. He is claimed, the way the executed black is claimed at the end of Go Down Moses. Not because he is good, but because he is redeemably bad, and in some important way, an extension of the family itself. A little bit of every member, black and white, executed in some impersonal northern death house as partial atonement for us all. And Alan Tate, at the end of his poem, The Swimmers, also claims for the community the dead black who has been lynched by local night riders. Claims him not only as a victim of corporate malice, but also as kinsman to every man who suffers the pain and indignity of being human. Indeed, the tendency to claim kinship is primarily what distinguishes Southern poetry and fiction from the more ideological strains of modern literature. Shirley Jackson, Sinclair Lewis, John Steinbeck, Ernest Hemingway, and others tend to disclaim some or most of their characters, to define themselves and, by implication, their readers as different, superior, saved in some limited secular sense from the aberrations of the aliens who inhabit their fictional world like pasteboard demons. On the other hand, Southern writers have claimed for themselves, their families, their region, the largest household of flesh and blood monsters in all of modern literature. Idiots, rapists, murderers, sodomites, sadists, hypocrites, lynchers, child molesters, maimers, necrophiliacs. Virtually every human depravity known to the police dockets or to Kraft Ebing. And they're all ours, they invariably suggest. And more to the point, they are all us. The source of such familial recognition is surely the religious vision of which Mr. Brooks spoke last night. Imperfect, ill-conceived, but something vaguely akin to Christianity. For though Southern writers are often theologically confused, or avowedly heterodox, or even skeptical, they all seem to be bound together by a kind of orthodoxy of the blood, which makes them less susceptible to the temptations of falsifying the fallen world. It is not, after all, a mere abstraction to talk about the brotherhood of man under the fatherhood of God, if you acknowledge in such a statement that there is more than a little of Cain in every brother. Any other meaning is the worst kind of theological or literary sentimentality. So we do believe in brotherhood down here, which should please Philadelphians, who after all hail from the city of brotherly love. Perhaps our brand is not precisely that of William Penn, but I cannot believe he would entirely reject it were he to understand fully what it meant. Besides, as Mr. Montgomery and I have already suggested, most of Southern literature is about Philadelphia anyway, and by extension, the Philadelphia Society. We can only hope that in the future, Philadelphians will write as honestly and lovingly about the South.